Hello, and welcome to the PC Pro Podcast. It is the 17th of October, 2019. I'm Tim Danton, Editor-in-Chief of PC Pro, and with me I have the fine gentleman known as Barry Collins.
Hello, Tim.
Hello. Darian Grunsmith.
Hello, hello.
You were very quiet there.
I'm sorry. Hello.
Hello. And also John Honeyball.
Hello. Sorry, I had Mixler on as well, so I heard everything 45 times over. But never mind.
Yes. Why don't we just plug Mixler just briefly? So if you have never listened to us live before, then we do broadcast on Mixler.com. So if you go to Mixler.com/PCPro every other Thursday, so the next one will be the 31st of October, then you can listen to us and interact with us by sending weird messages and just insulting us, which is what many people do. That's on Mixler, mixlr.com/PCPro. All right, Barry, first story, it's with you.
Yes, it is. It is my pleasure and duty to inform you that the legislation that was due to come in that would force us all to go down to newsagents to prove how old we were so we could look at mucky sites has been ditched. This is the government's long-held plans to stop young sprogs being able to access mucky sites on the internet. And they plan to do this by basically enforcing age verification on adult websites. There were a number of companies who are lined up to provide the age verification services, not least one that was owned by the world's biggest pornography site, Conflict of Interest, etc., etc. But they have decided pretty much, not quite the last hour, but certainly getting close, that this actually isn't a great idea after all. There was a written statement yesterday from the new digital secretary, Nikki Morgan, and I use the word new advisedly because she's been in that job for 2 months now, and so she could well be replaced at any moment. She put out a statement saying that after some long, hard thinking, the government didn't think this was the way to proceed, so they're not going to proceed with this part of the bill. They're still obviously very committed to not letting the sprogs see dirty, mucky sites, so they're going to try and shove it into their overall policy on online harms. But it seems, certainly for the moment and probably for the long term, that this has been smacked into the long grass.
So what's going to happen? So the problem still remains. So what is the government hoping to do about it?
That's not very clear. They certainly haven't come up with any alternative proposals. I think Nikki Morgan did hint at this in the written response. But one of the big problems that have been raised by several people, aside from the sort of huge security issues of these databases of adults being held everywhere, was that this would have no effect on pornography that was being hosted on social networks, which apparently is where a lot of kids are first exposed to this stuff. Obviously, you can't age verify social networks. So that was seen as a sort of they were implementing expensive measures that weren't really going to be effective because kids generally pick it up on these social sites. The other big issue, which people like the Open Rights Group have been moaning about for a long while, and, you know, indeed in PC Pro we've covered this several times, is that by creating these databases of people who wanted to access adult websites and having no real controls over those databases, there was no real regulatory environment around them, no industry standards really to follow, that it was an absolute honeypot for hackers, because here you are with these massive databases of people accessing adult websites, and if you wanted to create a database to blackmail people with, that would be pretty high on your list, I'd imagine.
Yeah. What's your take on it, Sean?
I'm certainly of the opinion that children should be protected from some of the nastiness out there. That's clearly right and proper. The problem is, you can't do it at the source side. You can only do it at the consumption side. Because if you try and do it at the source side, you're always running up against the problem that new sites will spring up and new data types and new sources and so forth. And ultimately, a kid's sharing a USB stick in the playground. So the problem is never, ever going to be fixable on the server side, let alone talking about legislative differences between what's allowed in the USA versus what's allowed in Sweden versus what's allowed here and so forth. And so that is completely impossible to nail down. And the methodology that they came up with to try to fix this was sort of typical laughable government IT policy. But it was never going to work. So I'm glad that that whole idea has been dropped. The problem is twofold. One, there is a real problem there that needs fixing. Of that, there is no question. And secondly, governments like to be seen to be doing something. And it almost takes on the element of we need to do something. This is something, therefore we'll do it. So I'm afraid to say this is going to be very unpopular with parents out there. And as a, you know, someone who isn't a parent with children, I'm trying to be very careful on treading here, because I can't at least claim the moral high ground of having kids to look after myself, though we do have six nephews between the age of whatever it is, 3 and 25. I think parents really do have to, at some point, step up to the plate and take control of their children's devices. And parental control and parental oversight is possible. It's built into iOS. It's built into Windows. There are tools. I mean, that's just for free built into these operators. It's built into Android. That's perfectly possible to do. There are third-party tools and platforms and capabilities if you want to go down that route. A lot of parental control stuff comes with antivirus packages, for example, let alone parental control filters, dedicated applications. And I'm afraid to say parents really do have to step up to the plate here. Now, I absolutely accept that way too much of this is far too difficult, far too awkward, and they don't even know that it exists. But at the end of the day, it is there, it is possible to use, and it should be possible for children to have a safe browsing experience on the internet, or a safe use of social media and so forth. Asking the likes of Facebook to get a grip and start authenticating people properly is, you know, laughable. It's never going to happen because, firstly, they're in a different legislative place from us. And it's not in their interest to do so. They don't want to take on that cost. So I'm afraid to say I'm pleased that this legislation has been dropped, because it was an absolute hiding to nowhere. And I would be a lot happier if parents were better informed and educated about what they can do to support their children.
All right. So I'm just going to go back to one of the things you said, because, Darren, you'll know all about this as well. Mm-hmm. But there are parental control systems. There are some built into Windows. They're rubbish, but they're there. And there are lots of third-party apps. I've tried using them, and they're universally awful. I'm pretty technically literate, I would say, and I could not find a good balance between blocking everything and basically having my children stage a riot with pitchforks and the like, and it just being completely pointless. So either way, the administrative burden it added was huge for the result that I got, which was basically more harm than good. But Darren, you may have a different view.
No, I haven't been in a position yet, thankfully. My daughter's only 4, so she hasn't yet been exposed to anything online any more offensive than Peppa Pig. But no, I completely understand. It seems that, you know, it's going to be inevitably an arms race, as it were, just constantly trying to block things, trying to stay one step ahead of the game, while new sites and new ways of sharing stuff, both from curious kids saying, hey, look at this, and also perhaps from, you know, more shady, more predatory sources as well, are just going to keep on coming up. So it does seem like it can't be, you know, just it can't be a single, you know, set and forget technical solution. And I agree with John that it can't be regulatory either. It certainly can't be a government just coming in and saying, that's it, we're stopping all porn, and now we've said we're doing it, it's done. The one thing I'm interested in as a potential, maybe a medium-term solution, or at least, you know, a measure which could really do some good, is a story which came out this week. We decided not to talk about it on this podcast, but it was just a little interesting one that Google is starting to use machine learning to provide audio descriptions of images that come up from an image search. And I think, you know, the use of machine learning obviously can be a lot more broadly applied. And I think there's a very good chance in the next few years. I don't know what the current state of this is, but the technology will only get better and better at recognizing pornography and proactively stepping in to block individual images, videos, whatever, no matter where they're embedded, no matter how they come down the line. And I feel that, you know, because, you know, as they say, I know what pornography is when I see it. Similarly, one hopes that an AI can make that same judgment, which is impossible to make just by coming up with block lists or whatever. So I'm optimistic that if the day comes when Scarlett is exposed to, via one way or another, a dodgy site, the technology will be there to step in and say, whoa, hang on a second, get permission from your dad or whatever before proceeding. But yeah, that's a medium-term solution rather than a today one.
I think that's the thing. I don't think the solution is technological, because I think there's always going to be a way around filters or, you know, even the... I agree with what you're saying, Darren, about the AI recognising images and stuff like that. That could go a long way. But the solution for me as a parent of a 15-year-old and a 9-year-old is parenting. And that is making sure they're not sitting in their rooms for hours on end, or even, you know, with the youngest, we make sure that if she's now got a phone and previously she had a tablet, that she's sitting down in the living room with us when she's watching stuff or watching video on there. So I can see what's going on. I tell them both, even though there's only a very slim bit of truth in it, that they know I'm a technology journalist. They know I have access to the router, that I can see every website that they both visit. And I don't really have that power, but that is, and I think it's partly enough for them to think twice about going to see something they shouldn't. You know, I think just being proactive in your parenting is harder with a 15-year-old. I absolutely agree. You've got to give them some degree of liberty, in the same way my parents had to give me some degree of liberty when there were dodgy VHS videos flying around in the 80s and 90s. You know, this is always going to be a parenting problem. Parents just have to adapt to the new technology.
I agree. And you know, I think, yes, technology can help, and AI processing feeds and all of that stuff, that's all terribly, you know, lovely, except that doesn't actually help you unless you allow something like Google to become your in loco parentis for all traffic that may be going to a child's computer. And then that in itself comes up with, you know, Google or Facebook AI or whatever. That in itself comes up with a whole bunch of privacy issues and so on and so forth. The unfortunate hard reality is it's a parenting problem. And I think parents can say with, you know, reasonable justification that this stuff is way too hard, way too complicated, and way too difficult. And I have a great deal of sympathy with that. I mean, if you just take, for example, whitelisting for arguably children under the age of 7, that's kind of okay. And blacklisting works reasonably well in terms of websites, if we're only talking about websites, for children over the age of, say, 11. But how do you transition from a whitelisting to a blacklisting environment? And that in itself is incredibly difficult, and something that the packages do a very, very bad job at. And that's only one small part of it. So I don't know. I think, you know, and it's not just a matter of filtering and so forth. It's a matter of what apps are being allowed to be installed onto a child's tablet or phone. And this is a deep and complicated problem. And the platforms themselves, although they're doing a moderately reasonable at the problem, are, you know, they're doing thinking of 10, 15 years ago, and that's not good enough.
But again, the apps is another thing that parents can solve. On both of our kids' devices, we have the password to install if they want to install apps. So that they have to come to us if they want something. Now, you know, there's web browser on that phone. you can't block them from seeing everything. But I think the sort of partial, I don't like the word, but the sort of threat of worrying that dad or mum is going to see something, combined with a modicum of technical measures. And I don't want to sound blasé, and I think also I've got two girls. I suspect the problem is worse with boys. But you know, I think it's achievable. At least I think it's the best possible solution. I don't think these ham-fisted government attempts to filter stuff are ever going to work.
I think it's fair to say that if a parent wants to do something proactive and caring and so forth, they can do so if they're prepared to put some effort in.
Yes.
The problem is that, unfortunately, you know, take your standard normal distribution curve, the lower half of the curve, which is like half the population, is neither interested or wishes to blame somebody else. And unfortunately, there is the element in our culture of it must be somebody else's problem to fix, not mine.
Okay. Well, I think we probably can't solve that particular side of the problem. So let's leave it for now. The only thing I will add is just if you are a parent listening to this with children of a certain age, then set the discipline early, because I made the mistake of being too lax at the start. And it's very, very difficult, I can tell you, to come back from that. Okay, let us move on to the next story, which is with you, Darren. You've been boning up on Libra.
I have. Prior to this, I just thought Libra was a star sign. But so Libra, as you will know if you were paying attention back in June, is Facebook proposed digital cryptocurrency. They announced it in June, but it's planned to launch next year. And in fact, the first major meeting of the partnership, all the different companies that were going to work together on it, was on Monday. Now, when I first heard about this, I thought, well, why does Facebook want a currency? But there are obviously some quite good reasons for that. If Facebook can allow you to spend money, send money, order things, you know, and make microtransactions in games and so on, all on its one platform, you know, it gives you much less incentive to ever leave that platform. It encourages you to spend more time on Facebook, and also it maybe gives them the possibility of getting a better idea, you know, more opportunities to monitor what you're doing with your money, and hence a better profile of you. Libra is not exactly like Bitcoin because it's not decentralized and you don't generate them by mining. It's much more like a standard bank. The service partners, the various companies that signed up, are supposed to be able to create new Libra currency based on demand. So it's a very different model. It's much more like a kind of a classical national currency. And that's sort of part of the issue, really, because that moves into a situation. Well, in fact, Bitcoin itself, when it first started, there were all sorts of legal questions it threw up. But certainly there's definitely regulatory issues that arise from basically making money and selling it for real dollars or euros or whatever. Originally, Libra had some big companies on board, including Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, who have a lot of experience and a lot of expertise of handling payment processing. But these have all recently left just during October. They've all stepped down, probably because they became a little nervous, a bit apprehensive about exactly what they were signing up for and the questions that were going to be asked. It was suggested by some US senators that they would come under increased scrutiny if they continued to work with Libra. The latest one to leave is Bookings Holdings, which is a big online travel company. So it looks like Libra might be in quite a bit of trouble. That said, it's still got some big names behind it, including Spotify, Uber and Vodafone. But with the big payment processors bailing on it just ahead of the first meeting when it was going to be, you know, formalized and all signed up to who was going to do what, analysts are starting to say that Libra looks like it might be dead on arrival.
And they all left pretty much on the same day. Well, not every single one of them, but Visa, MasterCard, Stripe, they all kind of disappeared within a few hours of each other.
Yes, they did. I don't know if that was deliberately coordinated or if there was some particular piece of news that came out internally or whatever. But yes, as has been pointed out, it happened before the big meeting where they'd be expected to actually sign up and make a proper commitment. And the flip side of that means that anybody who did sign up is probably therefore in it for the long haul. So there are still some companies that that are as committed to Libra as Facebook is.
But can it work, though, without payment processing, widespread payment processing?
Yeah, that very much remains to be seen. I mean, we are, you know, Facebook's model is to move fast and break stuff, as they say. And certainly they're trying to move fast, and maybe they will break some existing models of how currencies are, you know, are handled, are what's the word I want, you know, are passed back and forth, are exchanged from one currency to another. Germany and France, I should mention, have actually said they would ban Libra entirely because it could interfere with their monetary policy and challenge their sovereignty. You know,
that doesn't sound like that big a deal.
No. It certainly is it is another setback for Libra. But you know, as okay. I say, there are a lot of companies which are in it, which are now signed up. So although analysts are saying it looks like it's a goner for the time being, it continues to be developed and pushed by Facebook.
Okay, so what are the key companies that have signed up and are in it?
Well, as I say, Spotify, Uber and Vodafone are the big ones, and there's some VC companies as well, some venture capital companies. Don't know what the size is of their investment, but you know, they obviously still think there might be something to be made back from this. There's a load of other ones as well, which I personally haven't heard of. The one payment processor that is still involved, I believe, is PayU, but they haven't made a public statement about what they see their role being going forward. There's Lyft as well, which is a bit like Uber. Who else? Coinbase has obviously experience with blockchain and cryptocurrencies. You know, there's it's not just Facebook going it alone by any means.
Okay. John, have you read up on this at all?
Oh, well, I've been looking at it from the periphery, though I must confess, as soon as the idea of cryptocurrency, crypto or not, and Facebook was mentioned in the same sentence, it took an awful lot to stop me laughing very loud. I think I'm not surprised that the major companies are running away from it. I don't know what the bad news is that caused them to do so. Maybe they got scared that maybe they weren't going to be able to make the sort of money and returns that they were hoping to do, or what? I don't know. I mean, it's very easy to say that Facebook are involved and therefore it's laughably stupid, because who would want to do that? It's too easy to say that. But I think certainly the cold hard wind of the government waking up to cryptocurrencies and how these things are handled and regulated could well be enough to make these large players at board level think very carefully.
Okay, and Barry, you've been suspiciously quiet so far.
Oh, well, the one thing I've never worked out from Libra is what the benefit would be to me as a consumer to use it, and I'm still struggling with that. When you're saying people like Spotify don't, is that they're interested in it as customers using it as a payment mechanism, or
I would presume so, but I don't know. I mean, it's still very, very nascent. Like I said, they had their first proper meeting only on Monday, and I haven't seen any formal kind of declarations to come out of that yet regarding what the structure of Libra is going to be, assuming it ever properly takes off. But it makes perfect sense to imagine that Spotify could say, you know, they could put an advert on Facebook and say special discount if you sign up right now and give us your Facebook details and give us X Libra coins. You know, then you can have a special rate for your first year or whatever.
Yeah, I'd see. For me, that's fine, but you're going to need bigger companies. And the one company that could make this work, I think, is Amazon, because it has such a grip on retail that I think that's the company you've got to watch if they ever got involved in a cryptocurrency. Facebook, as big as it is, does not have people. Don't by and large spend on Facebook. Spend through Facebook. I know. You know, it has a huge advertising business, but, you know, the evidence for people actually spending on the site is fairly slim. So I just don't see that it's going to be a major threat. I might be wrong.
Well, we shall see. All right, let's move on to the next story, which is very clearly, and I'm not stalling at all. Oh, yes, we're back with you, Barry, because this is your baby, isn't it, really? Your baby went into a black hole.
Yeah, sort of. One of my existences is as editor of a Fortnite magazine, and this week Fortnite got to the end. So Fortnite runs in seasons, or at least it has until now. We just got to the end of season 10. Everyone was expecting to lull over into season 11 and find out a couple of new places on the Fortnite map. and suddenly Epic decided to up the stakes somewhat and move to what they call Fortnite Chapter 2, and they did this by taking the entire game offline for near enough 48 hours while they did so. They simply, at the end of they have an event, basically, a live event at the end of every season where players go into the world, the weapons are disabled, and you sit and watch something happen. What happened at the end of this event was the sort of island just disappeared into a huge black hole, and then the black hole was all you could see on the game for, like I say, nigh on 48 hours. You just, people were sitting there with a black hole on their screen going, what's going on? When's something going to happen? Occasionally, you'd just hear this little blang, and everyone would think, "Ah, oh, okay, something's happening. It's all going to go back on." And this went on, and they put numbers on the screen that meant absolutely nothing. And everyone was trying to work out what the code was. And there was a sort of mini game, Space Invaders, you could play if you pressed the right combination of buttons on your controller. But basically, for 48 hours, the biggest game in the world just shut down. And it came back to life on Tuesday lunchtime.
So why do you think they did it, Barry? Is it just a huge PR campaign?
Yeah, Epic are excellent at sort of generating social media hype and around the game. I mean, the things they've done over the years and the tie-ins they've done with different... So the last season, for example, they had a sort of Batman tie-in and there was a Gotham City place on the map. They've done... as I say, these big live events before. So a couple of seasons ago, there was a live concert with DJ called Marshmello held a live concert in the game. So they are very, very good at creating sort of hype around the game. And this was by far their best effort yet, because, like I say, for anyone, you think about it, this game makes Epic hundreds of millions of dollars a year. It's near enough billions now, and so to shut down for 2 days is a costly old exercise for them. That's going to have cost probably tens of millions of dollars, and yet it's the amount of news cycles and publicity and social media. I mean, Twitter, it was in Twitter highlights for 2 days straight. They've done a superb job of breathing new life back into a game that was starting to wane.
Do you have to pay to play Fortnite? Were there people who bought like a month subscription and found that for 2 days of that month they couldn't get online?
No, you don't have to pay. But what you do, it's a completely free game. There are cosmetic items in the game, so costumes, emotes, different what they call wraps to go around weapons and stuff like that. And the big worry was that, you know, all these kids who spent hundreds of million quid buying these things, when Epic made it look like the game had finished, and, you know, they were quite clever. Again, they deleted all the tweets off of their Twitter account. Instagram was cleared out. So it made it look like, you know, this is the end. And, you know, clearly it was never going to be the end, because it would be the biggest financial suicide since Brexit. But they
politics.
Yeah, sorry about everybody. But, you know, I suspect they've made the money back up in the time they've been back online.
Yeah, well, they certainly got the publicity. As you say, it's had major coverage everywhere, including the BBC, and the launch trailer has been viewed within the space of 2 days 12 million times. So, you know, that's not a bad kind of publicity, is it? Not a bad way to launch a new season.
One of the things I thought was interesting about this was that, I mean, that might just be that I haven't been paying attention, but to me it seems like a real watershed moment in the history of media, that this is the first time I can think of that a purely digital asset, a world that doesn't exist, has dominated the headlines in this way and become so. I mean, I was really just so unaware of Fortnite. I knew it as a thing that that Barry worked on when he got bored of Minecraft or something like that, but otherwise, you know, I wasn't really, you know, I knew so little about it, but just this has kind of catapulted it into, you know, becoming as real to the world of media and culture as, you know, as Beyonce or whatever.
And I think from an IT perspective as well, that every one of these updates, and I had this discussion with Paul Lockendon on Twitter yesterday, was the PC update, I think it was 26 gigabytes. And they didn't release this until, you know, they shut the game down for 2 days. Nothing was going on for 2 days. And you'd think they would trickle out this update, you know, slowly in the background, and didn't have to turn the servers back on, but they could update everybody's machine over the course of 36, 48 hours, but, not create a rush.
Well,
but
then
you
get clever clogs is like John Honeyball sniffing the packets and saying, oh, it's not really gone because I can see it's furiously downloading data at the moment.
Oh, come on. Would I have done such a thing? I think the whole thing was utterly delicious. I'm not a Fortnite player. I'm actually not a game player much these days anyway. But I thought the whole lot, it was clearly a marketing thing. There's no way they were shutting down this money tree called, you know, Fortnite. That was never going to happen. That would have been utterly unthinkable. But the amount of PR and hype that's been generated by doing it was, I think, masterful. But as I said, the most delicious part of it was, you know, thinking about all of these gamers absolutely panic struck. I think there's something quite sort of schadenfreude about that. I'm not quite sure how to express it, but the idea that people will be truly panicking over a virtual world game, I think is quite funny in a way.
There's one or two magazine editors who had a heartfelt or two as well. We put the deadline back to Monday when the season was due to start just to get the new stuff in, and then had to wait another 2 days when the printers are going beside themselves.
I mean, you see, therein lies the even more deliciousness, of course, because you're talking here about a virtual world that only exists on the internet and you publishing a print magazine.
Yes, the irony's not lost on me either.
Excellent, glad to hear it.
All right, well, I think that's probably quite enough about a virtual game. Let's move on to the, before we come to the hot hardware, we've got something a bit unusual. So this could be very, very clunky for anyone listening live, but we'll try our best. Basically, I went to the National Museum of Computing. Who else has been to that one, chaps? You must have been there, John.
Whereabouts is it?
It's the one in Bletchley Park.
Oh, I've been to Bletchley Park, so I must have been in there. I mean, Bletchley Park itself is utterly fabulous and everyone should visit, but I must confess I don't actually remember the National Museum of Computing, so I need to go back again, clearly.
Well, you do, and that's actually very interesting that you didn't notice it, because that's one of the problems they have. So they need more footfall. So they've got this amazing neighbouring venue, but the neighbouring venue takes all the headlines and it takes all the gloss. So you've got Bletchley Park sitting, you know, over there, taking all their lovely huts, etc. And then if you just carried on up the road, so past the main car park, then you would come to see the National Museum of Computing. And this is where actually you'll see a lot of the working models. So for example, the bomb is there. So you will not be able to see that at Bletchley Park. You won't be able to
in that
see...
case, I must have been there because I have seen the bomb operating. So, yes.
They moved the bomb.
Oh, okay.
Are we going to get picked up by terrorism things by saying bomb all the time? They moved the B-O-M-E. John, do you want to say quickly what the bomb is?
Please correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this the computational engine that was built in the Second World War to calculate the Enigma code stuff?
I was hoping you'd just know. It's like I left my way through. But it's the Turing-Welchman bomb. It was used to break the Enigma messages.
That's what I said.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, John. You're right. Well done.
Okay.
But you wouldn't have seen it. Well, you would have seen it at Bletchley Park, but they've moved it to the National Museum of Computing. And the other things you can see there are a working model of the Colossus. So they've just rebuilt it, and it is quite amazing. You just see all these, all these lovely valves. So you know, for people who aren't familiar, but before we had transistors, we had valves operated by heat. So you can just imagine how amazing that looks. Not quite as many transistors as we have in modern CPUs. I think we're up to about 6 billion in the 7 nanometer Kirin 980, for example.
Up numbers now, Tim, aren't you?
Yeah, just drown people with numbers. I think that's the best way to do things. But anyway, you've got these working models of very old computers. But what they also have, which is interesting, is they have a lot of the computers, especially from the 80s, sitting there. So if you wanted to go and have a play of Jet Set Willy, as an example, on one of these old computers, then you could do that. And it's one of the big differences between our Museum of Computing and the American equivalent. So I went to that one in August in San Francisco, well, near San Francisco, and you couldn't touch anything. I actually emailed the archivist saying, look, I'm doing this research, blah, blah. Can I actually just get the Apple II and have a little fiddle with it? And they said, no. If you touch it, you will be escorted out of the building by the security. So I didn't do that. Whereas the, like I said, the National Museum of Computing is great. It's very hands-on. You know, I just think it's a great resource. And I should say before I forget, we have negotiated a discount with the National Museum of Computing. So if you go there and just quote the code PC Pro 2019, then they will take 20% off the price, although it is a charity. So, you know, whether you really want to do that is up to you.
Do you have to say that to the person selling tickets, like a password?
Yes, you have to
go type into
PC Pro 2019. Yeah.
Well, you have to decipher it first. So otherwise, they won't let you in.
Well, it's only over at Milton Keynes, isn't it? If I remember rightly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I really ought to go and trundle over there and have another look, because it's not too far from me here in Cambridgeshire. Actually, talking about valves in such a condescendingly way, I thought was very impressive. You know, things that came before silicon. And my dad was actually a top electronic valve designer at English Electric Valve Company in Chelmsford, and he did an awful lot of high power radar stuff. So valves and me, well, I am old enough, I guess, anyway, but valves and me go back a long time. If they need footfall and stuff, then we should probably offer to do some sort of PC Pro evening event or something. How about that?
Yeah, I think we could definitely do that.
But go along and give a talk or something.
Yes, I dare say that could work. Because you're doing those talks, aren't you, John? You're going to
sometimes, yeah.
Quite soon.
I'm doing what, sorry?
You're going to Beaconsfield, I do believe.
Oh, no, I'm going to... I'm actually going there tonight to the National Institute of Film and Television. But that's actually to listen to a talk rather than give one.
Oh, okay. That's probably for the best.
Probably, yes.
So, yes, we could definitely do that. And actually, someone on Mixlr, so this is Doc Bams, I don't know how you'd say that, has pointed out that there is also the Leicester Retro Computer Museum, which I've never been to, but it gets 4.8 stars on Google. And that is, as the name suggests, based in Leicester. That's also apparently...
Well, it's the best place for it, really.
What are you trying to say, Barry? Who else are you trying to alienate? You've already got everyone who voted.
No, I'm just saying, if you're gonna put the Leicester Retro Computer Museum anywhere, I'd put it in Leicester.
Okay. Well, the point is it's the retro. Never mind. The point is it's a retro computer museum that I've never been to in Leicester. I've no affiliation with this. Okay. So anyway, one of the things that I did whilst I was there was I chatted to Andrew Humbert, and so. Darren, are you all lined up with your special finger?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. So what we're going to do is, at this point, we're going to play you an excerpt from that interview.
What we want to do is tell the story of the history of computing, where it started from, and essentially, you know, educate, inform and entertain. Obviously, you know, we're a museum open to the general public. What we find is, you know, particularly when families come round, you get these kind of generational things. You know, grandma and granddad kind of, I use one of these mainframes, or those produce my gas bills. And, you know, mum and dad start pointing at Commodore PETs and BBC Micros, and the kids are kind of going, oh, this is boring. and so, yeah, just to remind people of some of this history, and explain how the machines evolved and such like. We put a lot of effort into our education program, which, you know, is supportive of the national curriculum in computing, which is why we do things like Raspberry jams and things here and so forth. So when we bring a party of school kids here, typically they stay sort of two quarter days with a lunch in the middle. Rest time, obviously, is traveling. Half of their time is a tour of the museum to tell them about the history. But as you tell them about the history, you can explain some of the fundamental concepts of computing, like memory, by showing how it's changed, and you know, difference between RAM and hard disk and so forth. It's kind of easy when they're in separate places. You can show how some of the ideas have evolved, you know, from paper tape to USB sticks, and you know, give them some idea of what the pace of technology development is like, and you know, the evolution from valves to transistors to microcircuits, and so forth. So yeah, we take them through the timeline so they see how computing has changed, how the technology has changed, how the applications have changed, the way you use computing has changed, and who used it. And then in the second half day, we sit them down and get them to do some programming. And interestingly enough, we still use BBC micros.
Do you? So still using BASIC, despite its critics?
Despite its critics. Well, we're not aiming to teach them programming. We're aiming to open their eyes to it. So the reason the BBC micro works is it's sufficiently like a modern machine, a PC or a Mac. It's got a screen and it's sort of graphic, although it's pretty simplistic. BBC BASIC is quite a nice language for writing toy programs. So what we give them is a broken program and invite them to fix it.
Okay.
And we do it in a slightly competitive beat-the-clock kind of way, and it's really quite fun to watch. And that gives them an appreciation of what's involved in programming and debugging and the fun of actually getting a machine to do what you want it to do. So we run them through that, and then we get them to build a program that talks to a database so they can ask queries and get answers back. And then we do a little question answering thing, and we spin a bit about AI around that to give them a taste of different applications, different ways that apps are developed. And our hope is that they go back to school having a better understanding of the fundamentals of computer architecture, because I've actually seen on the big machines, you can see the different boxes, central processor, memory. It's much easier than peeling the covers off something. And they've done something practical. And you know, if there's a latent computerist in there, hopefully, you know, we've thrown the spark in and set fire to them. And if they're not a latent computerist, well, hopefully they've had a good day out and they're just a bit better informed. So when they get to use technology, you know, they're not frightened of it. So the schools program is important to us. The other overlay, obviously, being here on Bletchley Park, is the link back to the wartime code breaking. And you know, the bomb machine was built by one of the ancestors of ICL, a computer company, and is essentially punch card technology in its engineering. It was built in Letchworth, not so far away. And the Colossus was built by the phone company and was built on the back of automatic telephone exchange technology. And you know, you can link that to modern telephony and internet and so forth. So again, it kind of helps them understand that a lot of things that we take for granted today, the seeds were planted a long time ago, and it's been quite a journey to get to the point where it's all, you know, as whizzy as it is now.
And in terms of the development of the... So I went to the US equivalent in San Francisco, I can't remember, or some, the Bay Area, I can't remember exactly where it is. And
it's in Mountain View. That's and it's lovely.
And it is lovely.
Yes.
But it is... It has a major drawback compared to here in terms of you can't actually touch the computers.
Yes.
I emailed the archivist and he said, nope, you can't touch anything. Yeah. We'll throw you out, which couldn't be more different.
So for us, keeping things running is an important part of what we do. We think of ourselves a bit like a preserved railway.
Right.
You know, people come here to see the things huffing and puffing, and half the fun is watching volunteers wandering around fixing things. And, you know.
But you could, you must look at that American one. I think we could do it a little bit there, Stardust, you know, their glitz. Or do you not think that?
No, I do. It would be magnificent if we had a fairy godmother turn up and gave us the funding to develop the site. We've got an awful lot of stuff in storage. We've got too much on display. It's all very crammed in. It would be nice to spread it out more and interpret it more. It would be nice to be able to have a full-time curation staff. We're very dependent on volunteers, and I certainly wouldn't want to lose volunteers or push them out, but yes. You know, all that needs strengthening. Essentially, that is a strategic planning and fundraising question, and that's the kind of thing that trustees worry about.
Yes, yeah.
We're doing an awful lot with what we've got. We are limited by the buildings and the fact we are only a tenant.
So would you ideally look to relocate then?
Ideally, would like to develop this site in partnership with our landlords.
Right.
Okay, there you go. So that was Andrew Herbert. And I should have said before he started speaking, he is well worth listening to because he is actually formerly a chairman of Microsoft Research UK. He's been a British computer scientist working at many interesting companies throughout his career, and is one of the many people who's come from the University of Cambridge, from the many fine technologists who's appeared from there. And he is currently, as I say, he's chair, I think I'm right in saying, of the Board of Trustees for the National Museum of Computing. All right, so just to repeat, please go there. Visit it. It'll be great. Actually, whilst I'm doing little plugs, we have an offer to podcast listeners who don't already subscribe to PC Pro. If you go to subscribe.pcpro.co.uk/podcast by the Sunday, the 20th of October, then you can get the next issue of the PC Pro as part of your subscription. So you'll get there in time. It's the regular offer, but it's the regular excellent offer of 3 issues of PC Pro for £1. So each issue delivered no extra cost. You get it before it hits the shops. I should say this is only available in the UK, this particular offer. But if you have never subscribed to PC Pro or have not subscribed to us for a while, subscribe.pcpro.co.uk/podcast. All right, let us move on to the final item on our agenda, which is the hot hardware of the week. This is something that has tempted John Honeyball to press the buy button. Not that it takes much to convince you to press buy, John. What have you bought?
I've just ordered up the new Pixel 4 XL. I was watching the really quite cringeworthy bad video stream of their launch. I'm starting in my crumbly old age to get very annoyed with this sort of pat kind of presentation style. But nevertheless, the Pixel 4 is out, and I like the larger form factor of the XL, so I have ordered one. I've ordered one because I think it's interesting tech. It's got the latest Android version on it. It will be supported first for sort of OS updates and so forth. This has been the history with Google's hardware, and I like what they're trying to do with the photography side, and it's going to be very interesting to compare what they're doing with where Apple goes, because behind this, of course, is that whole story about the best camera is the one that you always have with you, and which is why the camera market is imploding, because smartphones are doing most everything you could ever possibly want to do.
What is it that's so special about this camera, though, John? Because I looked at it, and it's not as if they've covered it, smothered it in lenses like
No, I believe it's a two-lens thing, unlike Apple's three-lens thing. But they're applying an awful lot of AI and machine learning smarts to it, which is interesting because some of this stuff can work really well and some of this stuff can look truly awful. And look, you end up with what looks like a horribly fabricated photograph. And when it works, great, but oh my God, when it goes wrong. So I'm really interested to see where their state of the art is in terms of their machine learning on photography. And what happens when you give it some difficult scenes like, test charts and so forth, and just see how well it does put stuff together. So it's a complete nerdgasm for me, I must admit. I don't particularly want to use a Pixel 4 on a day-to-day basis. I'm very happy with my iPhone 11 Pro. But it's a platform that I need to know about, so I've ordered one.
Yep. Because there's much of it that it's not revolutionary, is it? We've got the 8... So it's got the same old Snapdragon 855 processor, Which obviously is very, very fast, but it won't be as fast as the A13, is it, in the iPhone 11?
Yeah, the A-something, yes.
Yes.
I'm not particularly bothered by that because I think, you know, there's specs for specs' sake, and at the end of the day, is it really going to make a huge difference? I mean, the iPhone 11 Pro doesn't actually feel particularly faster than the whatever version it was I had before, the 10 Max Pro thing or whatever it was called. I can't tell the difference, and it's supposed to be 100% faster, and in use you would never know. So I'm not bothered about the spec side of it. It's more where they're taking this line of engineering, I think, is interesting. Revolutionary, no, not at all. And in terms of its actual primary function, in terms of what it does for you, it's same old, same old. And that in itself is really rather boring. I really would like to see somebody do something quite revolutionarily different. Revolutionary, if I could use such a term. Different in smartphone world. And I think there's huge opportunities there for a major step forward. But this isn't it. But nevertheless, there's enough in there to make me reach for my credit card.
Yes. Is there anything in this to make either of you excited, Barry stroke Darian? It's not a command.
No, I had one eye half on Twitter, kind of waiting, as you say, for the thing that would be exciting, that would be revolutionary. But I mean, as the name implies, it's very much an iterative, step forwards. And you know, I do get that cameras are, you know, photography is an area that is fun. You know, it's kind of, it's really very human. It's kind of, it's exciting in a way that silicon isn't normally. And I do quite like the idea that, I mean, as John says, kind of using AI to enhance your images can have mixed results. But the thing I really love about this is you can use machine learning iteratively. And if they have a system, which I don't think they do at the moment, but they certainly should, where you can say your AI has screwed up this picture or your AI has done a great job with this picture, then they could, in theory, use that information to continue to refine the AI until eventually, you know, you can just take a picture of a blank wall and it will turn it into a Picasso. And I find that kind of thing very interesting and intriguing. But no, I mean, it's not thrilling enough. And I think it says a lot. I do know one person who was eagerly awaiting the Pixel 4, and that was solely because she has a Pixel 2 and the battery has become unacceptably poor. That's the target market, I think. People just want more of the same, but just refreshed a little bit.
John, did you look at the gesture technology?
No, that's on my list of things. I must confess, I sort of dipped in and out of the presentation because I found it so toe-curlingly boring and horrible. So I must confess, I kind of saw some bits I liked and waved the credit card. So I'm looking forward to exploring these new bits. They're claiming it has sort of radar stuff that you can wave at the phone. It'll understand what you're trying to do. So, I mean, let's just see how well that works and how well it works with existing apps.
Yeah, it's meant to detect kind of small motions that around the phone, and through these little gestures, you can do things like snooze alarms or skip songs or the other example they gave on Expert Reviews is cycling through YouTube playlists.
Yum.
None of this is going to change the world, is it? Let's
no,
let's
not at all. I mean, that's all sort of techno wank, if I can use such a phrase. It's solutions.
You just
that
did.
I just did. Solutions that don't really have a significant impact on the day-to-day operation.
I'm not sure I agree there, actually, because, I mean, I'm very interested in kind of next generation or evolving ways of interacting with technology. I feel Android in particular has become a bit bogged down by just too many different sorts of controls and too many different interfaces. And in particular, it's different from phone to phone because of different overlays. It's different from version to version. You move from Android P to Android Q and suddenly, you know, things are different. And I think, I really want to get away into entirely from this idea you just have to know where to stab, or you have to look and hunt and find the right place to touch with a finger to use your phone to interact. I do want to get to a position where we have a much more kind of simple, intuitive vocabulary, whether that's gestures, whether that's something else, I don't know. But it has to be, I mean, ultimately it has to be universal and it has to be intuitive. But you've got to start somewhere.
And that's another reason for going for the Google Pixel phone for me, is that it's not going to have all of this layered nonsense on top of it. You know, I've got a Samsung S10 sat in front of me, or S9 or S10 or something, and it's just filled with stuff I really don't want to be there, and which doesn't sit nicely, and it seems to be, you know, throw anything onto the phone and hope some of it sticks. I really want to get back to a purity and a simplicity in smartphones, but we're not losing the smartness. And maybe this is where sort of the AI and learning and so forth can really help. But I'm tired of having 90 icons and all of this complexity and depth.
Okay. You haven't actually talked price yet, John. So how much are we talking for this?
Oh, robust. I can't remember. It was like 800 quid or 900 quid for the full one, something like that. I'd have to look it up now. You've asked me difficult questions.
Well, it's 669 for the basic Pixel 4 with... Right. I think that comes with 64 gigs of RAM.
Yeah, it does. God. Yeah.
Yeah. So then if you have to go up to... 128, that's 769. So that's still pretty steep. I mean, especially when Google is offering the 3A for a much cheaper price, much more reasonable price, in my view. But for the Pixel 4L, John, you're absolutely right. So it's 829 for the 64 gig and 929 for 128. Has this got expandable storage? I haven't checked.
That's what I was just looking for.
No idea. I bought the 128 in black of the XL.
Okay, all right.
And I think it's due next week or the week after when I'm in America.
Perfect. Well, if you find out whether that's got expandable storage, do let us know, Barry. In the meantime, if you are on Mixlr, then please cast your votes. But did anyone see the other announcements in that Google launch?
There's the new Wi-Fi Nesty home assistant thing that does what various mesh systems have already done, which is turn the router hub, the router part of a mesh system. You know, Google already has its Google Wi-Fi system. They've built in the Google Assistant to that. So it's a neat bit of convergence because it's one fewer box to have around your home. And also it kind of makes a lot of sense because as we're occasionally told, we tend to keep our routers in out of the way in conspicuous places rather than having them out on display, which makes perfect sense, but it can interfere with their Wi-Fi performance. You really want your wireless router to be somewhere really central and visible in the middle of your home, and making it something which is a bit more of a home appliance motivates that. So I thought this was a real good kind of step forward, but I was very disappointed to find that, first of all, it seems that the satellites don't have the Google Assistant built in, so you can't just have three of these new, what's it called? I think it's Google Nest Wi-Fi Plus or something stupid like that, something really forgettable, not the sort of name that Apple would give it, but you can't have a system which has conveniently satellites with the built-in Google Assistant just strung across the length of your home. And the other thing is, I cannot believe it's October 2019 and Google is releasing a new Wi-Fi system that doesn't have 802.11ax. I think that's a ridiculous misstep, and it's just, you know, to me that kills its stone dead straight off.
Oh, I hadn't spotted that. That's particularly stupid of them, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it should be AX now, without question. In fact, actually, if they had been really impressive, they would have put a 5G Pico cell in there as well. If they were really, really on the cutting edge,
I've got to assume that they were just a bit price averse, because AX stuff hasn't come down in price with the speed I hoped it would, probably because there's just no damn clients out there, so nothing's really driving the demand at the moment. Actually, does the iPhone 11 have AX?
No.
I don't know.
No.
The Galaxy S10 does. Anyway, yes, so all of the decent AX routers I'm seeing are £300 and up. So yeah. I imagine building
that's an opportunity for someone as big as Google to do something, you know, that shakes the market up. I've just been looking at the specs for the Pixel 4 XL Plus thing, and it doesn't appear to have any micro SD card option.
No, it doesn't.
So 128 gig for the big one is a little bit on the mean side, but then it is 500-600 quid cheaper than my iPhone 11 Plus Pro Max thing, which is 512.
I said that Apple would come up with a better name than the Google one, but yes, maybe they've kind of maybe they've lost that magic lately. Their naming mojo.
Okay, well, let us cast our votes then, chap. So, John, I think we know where you stand. Darian, what about you?
I'm struggling to call it hot. I'm interested in the gesture stuff, and you know, obviously, any improvement is positive. But I don't think hot is the right way to describe this particular, as I say, iterative generational update. So I'm afraid,
therefore,
by a process of elimination, it's cold.
But if you started from cold, though, you may have ended up at hot by a process of elimination. I see a flaw in your process there.
I'm very sorry. I'll go away and analyse my processes and get properly ISO certified for next time.
Please do. Barry.
Yeah, I'm sort of with Darian. I am quite tempted by the whole Pixel philosophy, as John said, of a nice clean phone with no Samsung gubbins in the way. The lack of external storage, I think, might be the nail in the coffin for this particular phone for me, because of the 128 is pretty pricey, and there's no good reason not to have a slot in there. So, tepid to cold, I'm afraid.
Okay, and actually, John, I haven't pressed you on hot or not, so which way are you going to go?
Well, you never allow me to say lukewarm.
Because of the name of the segment is called Hot or Not.
I know, you're just so unhelpful. I think I'm going to, despite having laid out the cash for it, I think I'm probably going to go with cold, because I don't think actually there's going to be enough there to make it a hot product. But I think it is certainly going to be interesting.
Yeah, no, it's a not from me as well. Not least because they never bring down their prices, so you can't even watch the Pixel 4 and see if it drops like you can with the Samsung. It just always stays at and particularly for 164 gigabytes isn't enough now, in my view, and even 128 gigabytes is pushing it. So that's a not. Let us see what the comments are. So we have mostly nots. I'm struggling. We've got David Artis, who says, I think it's warm. Again, David, I would point out it's hot or not. Paul _ F says, not hot. Paul R says, I think Google makes the best Android phones, and I like that they ditched the notch, so hot, but would only consider buying it when the price comes down. Whereas Ian Orford says, all they do is improve the cameras and remove useful things like fingerprint readers and headphone sockets. Not hot. So thank you very much for that. Michael Deers are not hot. Mike C. R is a cold. And then we have, oh yes, I saved Ryan's till last. So this is from Ryan C. Ryan Thomas. It was the hottest of phones. It was the coldest of phones. But mostly it was the merest of phones. So thank you for that. I think that's everything, isn't it, guys? Is there anything that you wish to add at this point?
I'm putting this on the spot, Tim.
I should have a grand rant about eSIMs, but that's for another time.
We can cover eSIMs another time. And John, did you have a theory, just incredibly briefly, on why that Samsung phone could be unlocked with any fingerprints?
Oh yeah, there's this news thing that I saw on the BBC today about the new Samsung phone fingerprint reader. If you put a screen protector on it, one of these translucent plastic things, then any finger can unlock the phone. It's almost as if, it's one of those sort of staggering duh moments, really. it would appear that their new fingerprint reader is using ultrasonic sound or something to measure the finger. And once you've set up a finger, then any old finger will do. It's apparently there is a software patch out now or coming real soon now. No surprise there. But a distinct lack of testing, I would suggest.
Yep, so it seems. All right, thank you very much. So until the next podcast in 2 weeks' time, it's goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.